All right, John, the Arms Room Show with Glenn.
Andrew.
And thank you to all of our patrons for your support of the show. We always appreciate what you guys are out there doing. Not, you know what, not just for us, but I know that if you're supporting the show, you're supporting other great industries, you're supporting other great people within those industries. I know you're out there doing good things in your community. So thank you for your support of us, because that tells me the kind of person that you are. You could get the show for free, and instead you support it, and I appreciate that. In addition to just, you know, saying thanks, make sure you're getting the extra show that we put on for the $10 and above patrons, which is the majority of our patrons, every month. And we talk about a different topic every month. Usually it's something kind of personal. Remember, if you are a patron and you want to give us a topic for that show, feel free to do so. Last month, we talked about the 5 love languages and how we apply them not just to our personal lives and relationships, but even how I apply them to training and teaching. So check it out. News. I think the only news that I really have been following is the trucker strike in Canada.
I don't even know anything about anything.
Well, basically, the Canadian government is implementing these insane vaccine mandates, including that truck drivers who drive by themselves have to be vaccinated. You're talking about people who literally spend over half their day by themselves in a truck.
Why is this still a thing?
Because it's about control. It's never been about safety. It never will be. So it's over 40 miles long. And the organization, I forget the name of them, that is making this happen, has now reported that they've received enough funds to keep the trucks parked in front of the Parliament building for between 3 and 4 years.
Oh my God.
Now, based on what we're seeing in Canada, now American truck drivers are saying the same thing. And I want to pause here and I want to say something. American truck drivers keep the American economy rolling, literally and figuratively. Without truck drivers transporting things, we are all screwed. All right? So if the trucks stop running, my friends, we all go, yeah, fuck the government, yada, yada. But if the trucks stop running, the supply problems that we already have are just going to get worse. And so, again, it's a good time, if you haven't in a while, maybe go stock up on some things, obviously. But it's also a really good idea to keep an eye on what's happening both in Canada and also here in America.
Yeah.
This is important stuff. This is the kind of stuff, it's like the Kyle Rittenhouse case. Like, this kind of stuff is going to set a precedence for what's going to happen next. How this is handled, what happens with these people, what they choose to do is going to set a precedence for what happens next.
Yeepers.
One of our wonderful listeners sent this one to me, and it's it's funny news, but it's also the kind of thing that, like, when you have a government that literally has no limitations from the people, this is the kind of shit that they do. You ready for this? China has censored the Fight Club movie. So, of course, if you've seen the movie Fight Club, you know that Brad Pitt's character, Tyler Durden, also played by Edward Norton, mm-hmm. because, of course, they're the same people, schizophrenia or whatever. At the very, very end, he reaches over and grabs that crazy chick. I can't remember her name. She's like a crazy chick in every movie she's in. And mm-hmm. he reaches over and grabs her hand as the bombs go off that his Club Mayhem, or whatever they called themselves, set into all those financial buildings, and you watch all the buildings fall. And, of course, that is, you know, they're resetting the financial world to zero, so to speak. China has removed the ending of this movie, which came out 22 years ago.
Came out that long ago?
Yeah, I'm old as fuck. I was in college when that was happening. I'm just kidding. I wasn't in college. Drew was a baby.
Yeah.
Sucking on a bottle at that time.
Almost.
No, but just before the bombs go off, this is what China's done. The screen cuts to black, and then text pop-ups that says, "The police rapidly figured out the whole plan and arrested all the criminals.
Shut the fuck up.
Preventing the bombs from exploding. Tyler Durden was sent to a lunatic asylum," and then credits roll. This is what happens.
I'm Googling it right now.
Do it. This is what happens when you allow a government to just do whatever the hell they want and just have full control. So if you find it, let me know, because that's pretty funny. Anyways, thanks to our listener who sent that in. That's pretty funny. I got a good laugh out of it. Red Wire gear moment. Last week, I talked about pushing and pulling magazines. I talked about push-pull magazines, and this is against what most people do when they insert mags. Most people, when they insert a magazine into any magazine-fed weapon system, they just could jam it in, right? They just whack, smack it in, and that's all well and good. But if I don't give it a quick tug to make sure it's properly loaded, the likelihood of it then coming back out exists, and it exists pretty highly under more stressful circumstances and differs from weapon system to weapon system. I will tell you this. As someone who has been around firearms my entire life and professionally been around firearms since I was 17 years old, I can tell you this. I have seen more fucking magazines fall out of guns after reloads, especially mag exchanges, than literally I can even remember. That's how many times it happens. From special operations dudes all the way down to people who just got their guns. Push, pull your magazines. It's my moment again this week. Why? Because this past weekend we taught a defensive carbine class. There was a lot of people in this class, a very full class. We had a great time, tons of great students, definitely a phenomenal program that was taught just because of the quality of the students who showed up. At least 5 to 6 times, including twice during the Top Shot competition, magazines fell out of guns and hit the deck. In one case, a magazine fell out of a secondary system as it was drawn because the first system went tits up. So a secondary system was drawn, the magazine fell out. What a bummer that would be in real life, that your primary system goes down and you draw your secondary and the freaking magazine falls out because you didn't properly secure it. I'm telling you guys, this is worthwhile to change your technique. Insert the magazine forcefully and then give it a tug on every single weapon system that you own, use, whatever, that is magazine fed. Because it buys you everything and it costs you nothing. Yep. But if you don't do it, it might cost you everything. So it's one of those things that I'm telling you is worthwhile doing. Red Wire Gear Moment brought to you by RedWireGear.com. And I wanted to mention something that happened. Yesterday, Drew and myself and our good friend Ben, one of our instructors, went out with our good friend Mark and from Arizona Machine Gun Ordnance, also AZ Gun Lord on Instagram.
Mark's Machinimonials.
Yeah, Mark married Drew and I up on a big, beautiful, high elevation mountain up in Colorado. And at that wedding ceremony, Drew and I got married. I held an M60. Drew held the PKM, kind of our belt feds of choice. And then yesterday, we had the opportunity finally, you know, several months later to hit the range with those and others. We had an RPD, we had a G36, a couple M4s, a black powder pistol. We had all kinds of fun stuff. We were having a great time. And we just had the time to go out and shoot for fun. And, you know, Drew got to shoot both of the matrimonial guns for the first time, both the PKM and the M60. And we did all kinds of
Instagram.
Ah, yeah, sure. It's a great photo. And then lots of run and gun with the little sub guns or the carbines and just a really good time. And it's always a reminder to me when I just get to go out and shoot for fun that it is just fun to shoot. I mean, we blasted hundreds and hundreds of rounds yesterday just in the name of fun. We received pretty much zero training value, other than teaching Drew how to load various different belt feds and how to really, you know, run, you know, a short burst on a carbine. Other than that, it was just for fun. And we were shooting at targets, of course. We're not just shooting into the dirt, but we were having a great time. And don't forget, you guys, go out and shoot for fun sometimes.
Yes.
Every time I go out and just shoot for fun, it reminds me, hey, man, this is fun. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget to have fun.
It was a good time.
Our topic for today is how to practice and improve a skill. Now, this, like many of our topics, like most of our topics, is a topic that was sent in by a listener. So thank you to that listener for sending in this. And in line, I should say, with the topic overall, he also sent a series of questions that he wants us to answer specifically about this. Now, I can tell you guys, this makes our job as the show host so much easier because I'm literally just going to answer these questions. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how to practice and improve skills generally, all right, any physical skill. So we're talking about anything that's going to demand a physical skill, whether that's movement-based, whether that's athletic-based, whether it's weapons access, or whether it actually is shooting, whatever it may be, physical skill demands a lot from both the brain and the body and their connections with each other. So I'm not going to get out of my lane here. And what I mean by that is I'm just going to tell you guys, and Drew can chime in here as well, of course, the things that I have noticed, the things that I have seen over my lifetime of doing this, but really focused on my 12 years of teaching and training people professionally full-time, and just how many shooters and fighters and medical students I have seen during that time. It's thousands and thousands of people. So I'm going to draw from a decent amount of data here. And because we work on people with various baselines of knowledge, from very beginner types who I just want to learn how to do medicine, I just want to learn how to shoot, I just want to learn how to fight, whatever that may be, all the way up to active duty special operations guys and active duty law enforcement, SWAT, and people who we kind of expect to operate a little bit higher of a level, high level competitors and athletes and things like that. As we've worked with all these people and everybody in between, I want to share with you some of the things I've learned. So before I even get started with this list of questions, I need you guys to imagine something with me. And I'm going to describe what we call the step learning process. And if you've been in class, you've seen me draw this on the ground. But I want you to imagine with me basically a series of squared off steps. And this series of squared off steps represents the hard steps that are required. And by hard, I don't mean difficult. I mean very specific, pointed even, that are required as we're learning a new skill. Let's take a baby trying to feed themselves for the first time. Any of you out there who are parents remember the quite hilarious and ridiculously messy experience of trying to teach a child how to feed themselves for the very first time. And there's multiple steps involved in eating. Now, if you broke it down, you could say step one is to orient yourself towards the food and the appropriate silverware, right? Step two is to put your hand on the correct piece of silverware. Step three is now to orient that piece of silverware to the food that you're now going to eat. Step four then would be moving that piece of silverware efficiently into that food, whether stabbing, scooping, or otherwise getting it into or onto the silverware. Now the next step is moving it towards our mouth in such a way that it doesn't fall off the silverware, which means it may have to be angled, it may be able to be flat, and it needs to be held in such a grip that, of course, we can securely hold onto it. It doesn't slip or fall out of our hand. The next step would then be opening your mouth and putting the food into your mouth, but not so far into your mouth that you fucking choke yourself, right? And if you're a baby, you've noticed they have a hard time with this step because there isn't a spatial awareness that's visual here. They lose sight of that food as it approaches their mouth, and that's why it often ends up on their cheek, on their chin, in their nose. Then you've got to bite down on this piece of silverware, but not biting like you're, a tiger. You've got to bite down with both your lips and your teeth, but do so in such a way that you can control the amount of pressure so you don't damage your teeth, but that you can remove the food from the silverware. And then we start the process of chewing and swallowing and all that. And that's a whole other process. But just in that process that I mentioned, there are many steps. And each one requires a very specific movement, and you could say a very specific set of skills. When was the last time in your eating that you ever broke it down to that many steps? Of course you haven't. Not since you were a baby and you can't even remember back then. You don't need to break it down to that kind of steps because that's now part of what I like to call your reflexive response, or what some people call muscle memory. We can now read, watch a movie, even talk while we're doing that process. And because of the repetition of the movements, it's easy for us to take that silverware, move it to the food, get the food in our mouth, eat it, and then repeat that action as many times as necessary. Now, what's particularly interesting is I want you to, next time you're eating, especially if you're eating in a group or in a restaurant, I want you to not really pay attention to what you're doing, rather pay attention to what others are doing. Watch what other people do. And what you'll see are several different methods of how to hold the silverware, how to access the silverware, where people put the silverware when we're not holding it. Do I put it at the top of the plate? Do I put it at the side of the plate? Do I put it on the plate? If I'm having a fork, is it tines up or tines down? If it's a spoon, does it go into the thing I'm spooning? Does it go onto the plate or onto the table or onto the napkin? Or does it stay in my hand? There's so many different methods. Some people will lean forward when they eat. Some people will lean back when they eat. Some people will sit straight up when they eat. Some people will move the food closer to their bodies, and some people will leave it wherever it was placed. There's a variety of different methods here, and none of them are incorrect, because as you'll watch adults eat, they all get the food to their mouth successfully for the most part. So look around and observe these people, all right? Assuming you're not at a bar or something like that where half the people are drunk, everybody will be able to successfully eat. But watch how many different methods that people use. Some people will add unnecessary steps. And some people have created such an efficiency that they have even maybe fewer steps or combined steps based on what I said. And this is all based now on this step learning process that no longer requires those pointed hard steps, but rather requires, if you can imagine with me, like a quarter of a circle from the start of the step.
It's like a rounded edge.
Yeah, there's all rounded edges. But it's not just individual rounded edges of the steps. It's a complete rounded process so that we just go from point A to point B in a nice straight line. We don't have to make individual movements. But when you were a baby, you did. Everything was challenging. Look, if you are currently, or you can remember, but if you're currently a young parent, or if you can remember being a young parent, look at the baby when it is doing this.
Yeah.
The level of concentration is discernible. All right?
They like stare at that stare, like, and they're like,
And the hand moves towards it and they miss.
Yep.
And they pull the hand back. And they grab shit. You know, you can almost hear it. I don't know if babies curse in their heads, but if I was a baby, I was probably cursing in my head. And then finally they get it, and the victory is obvious. The elation is there. And then the orientation to the food. It's a discernible. Oh, they orient that fork, that spoon, whatever they got, and bam, sometimes they stab it. Sometimes they knock it off the plate. Sometimes they miss completely. It is this concentrated effort that they make to finally get this. And when the baby finally gets through all these processes, of which there will be many failures, when they finally get to the point where they're eating on their own without making a huge mess, without spilling stuff all over the place, and successfully getting it from wherever the food is into their mouth, the excitement that they have, again, it's palpable. I mean, they're so excited to be able to do this. And if you watch once that point happens, they don't just go like, well, I got that now, so what's next? They don't do that because they're so young in their development stages. Their brain is like, okay, guys, we got to do this like 1,000 more times before I'm even going to tell you that you can fucking look out the window while doing this, okay? Mm-hmm. And then that kid will have multiple reps, and you will watch them with that same level of concentration over and over. And as time goes on and they get better, they'll start to now relax, look out the window, laugh with you. They'll start to do other – maybe they start picking something up with their other hand. Now they're double fisting it, right? They've got a spoon in one hand and a stalk of celery in the other, and they're fucking living their best life, and they've mastered getting the food to the mouth, and it's awesome to watch. And as adults, we fuck all of that up. Mm-hmm. Because what we typically do is we forget the pointed hard steps that it took to do something as simple as put food in your mouth that you would never think about today. If you've ever had the opportunity, and maybe I would say unfortunate opportunity, but I could perhaps just say opportunity, to watch someone who has had a serious accident or a debilitating disease or MS or maybe even Alzheimer's have to relearn it as an adult, it is so fucking hard. Because they have all this other shit in the way of them learning that process again. As a baby, because of the developmental stages that our brains are in, so much easier for us to think about what we accomplish in the first couple of years. You know, we go from being like literally a helpless sack of flesh to like we're upright, walking, dressing ourselves, eating, getting something out of the you know, pantry. We're playing with other kids. We're building, you know, simple puzzles. We're doing stuff. In an electronic age, I mean, hell, these kids, by the time they're two, they can turn on the tablet, they can access the game, they can do it all, shut it down, move on. Like, it's amazing, right? Mm-hmm. When your brain is in that learning stage, that developmental stage, what you can accomplish. So how do we get back to that? To me, how I often teach it is the step learning process. But it requires that same level of concentration that you see in that baby's face when they're trying to do this for the first time. They're not thinking about anything else. They're not thinking about whether or not they got to pay bills. They're not thinking about what someone said to them. They're not thinking about anybody watching them. They're not thinking about that. All that they care about is that they're trying to do this step. So the step learning process, I'm going to use the presentation of a handgun as an example. Step one, get a good stance. Whether you're on your back in a seat, standing up, I don't care. Use circumstance, what we call the best stance, circumstance, to get into a good, comfortable, balanced position. Step two, find your focal point. Now, don't lose your stance, but don't be reaching for your gun yet either. Find your focal point. From your focal point, obtain your grip. Now, that might include unconcealing. That might include disengaging safeties on holsters if you have retention holsters. That might include reaching into a bag or accessing it out of a nightstand drawer or whatever, however it is you're keeping it. Get a good grip on the pistol. Now you're going to work the presentation. Don't lose your stance. Don't lose your focal point. Don't lose your grip. If you do, stop. Go back down one hard specific step, reacquire what you've lost, and then step back up to presentation. Now we're going to do the elevator escalator presentation, which I can't obviously demonstrate to you guys, so you'll just have to kind of think with me in your head if you haven't taken one of our programs. Elevator up to the top of your chest, escalator, orient the muzzle, finger on trigger if you're ready to shoot, present up the escalator to your eyeballs, acquiring, if possible, a secondhand grip along the way. That's part of the presentation. Next step, good sight picture, appropriate to the size and distance of the target and the type of shot you're trying to make. When achieved, complete the next step, which is trigger press, straight back and to the rear in such a way that it doesn't disrupt the sights. Repeat as needed. You don't just fall back to trigger. You may have to fall back to sights. You may have to fall all the way back to grip. You may have to fall all the way back to stance if you've had to move or change positions. This stepped process is literally you stepping up hard or pointed specific steps as you go to each thing. Over time and with repetition, you'll find that you can round the edges out. So instead of having to be robotic, one, two, three, four. You can go one, two, three, four. You're flowing now. Now you're starting to get that muscle memory. How many reps does this take? Based on my experience, I would recommend to you 1,000 minimum of good, solid reps, which means if you start trying to go faster, if you start trying to skip steps already, you're going to fuck this up. Now, once you get those rounded edges and everything's going well and you're flowing from step to step to step, okay, cool. If you find a problem like, man, I feel like I'm flowing, but I'm still having a hard time seeing my sight, stop. Add a pointed step there. Literally, on the escalator movement, as the sights come up to the eyes, stop. Double check and make sure everything's the way you want it to be. Then continue to flow, but you might have to add that pointed step back in. And then eventually that nice big rounded edge, the whole step is now a huge rounded edge. And I don't go one, two, three, four. I don't go one, two, three, four. I go one to four. Mm-hmm. And it just flows. And I don't have to think about it anymore. Now I can think about other shit. Like the baby who finally got down to eating and can now look out the window and watch a bird while it eats successfully. Now we're doing that. Now I'm shooting and I'm communicating. Now I'm shooting and I'm moving. Now I'm shooting and then I got to reload. Not have to worry about the shooting part. I'll just focus on the reload right now. Whatever, right? Now we're adding in other things. Now, if at some point in time you hit a road bump, you're like, oh shit, I'm making a mistake somewhere. This is the hard part. You have to add that pointed step back in. So literally, as you're moving, let's say one to six, all right? Because I think that's what I gave us, six steps. So if we go one to six, and let's say presentation is where you're kind of fucking up. You're kind of whipping the gun out there, and you're not really – you don't have that natural body alignment presentation yet. So then go flow one to two, stop, or I guess one to three, stop, add a hard step in at 4, and then flow 5 and 6. When people say things like you have to slow down, this is what they're talking about or what they ought to be talking about. In fact, I'll back up there. I don't think most instructors have any fucking idea what they're talking about when they say slow down. They just see someone make a mistake and they go, whoa, partner, you need to slow down. I'm sorry, you want me to do poorly but slower? How will slowing down my failures help me fail less? That's stupid. Slow what down? Mm-hmm. Slow what down? Slow my presentation down? I have plenty of athletic people in class who don't need to slow their movement down. They don't need to slow their presentation down. They don't need to slow their grip down. They don't need to slow anything down. They might need to slow down their trigger press. They might need to slow down their sight acquisition. They may need to slow down their overall presentation. They need to slow down their grip. They may not be getting a good grip out of the holster. They need to slow down a thing usually. So we're going to flow until we get to that. Then we're going to stop, hard stop, physically fucking stop. Make it perfect and then continue. Eventually, you'll be rounding that edge out and then adding it back into the rounded process. To add it to another context, this is how I exercise. This is how I do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. This is how I teach myself a new skill. When I started running with Drew, my previous experience in running had been the baseball and the Army. That's it. And I ran like a Clydesdale. And I ran with Drew when we first started dating, and she said, you run like a fucking Clydesdale. And I've told the story on the show before, but here's where it applies here. She then showed me a couple of tweaks to make to my running. Now, here's the thing, guys. I'm a pretty fast learner, and I'm very good at adapting to new situations. For me to be able to just start running that way was painstakingly difficult. It took serious concentration. I stopped listening to music while I ran. I stopped talking to people while I ran. I got the right kind of shoes because my bad shoes were affecting my gait. I got the right kind of shoes. And then when we ran, I looked at my feet more than I did anything else. You know, I didn't run into anything. I made sure I was paying attention to where I was going, but I looked at my feet. I watched my feet hit the ground in a very specific way. And if they fucked it up, I stopped. And then I slowly started moving again, walking, making sure my feet were hitting the ground properly. And then I'd speed it up and speed it up and speed it up and speed it up until I was back at my normal pace and gait. And then I'm running differently. And I stopped so many times. And I had to restart so many times. Now, we were running several times a week, like we still do. And so it was a lot of reps for me. And obviously, your foot is hitting the ground. I don't even know how many times when you're running, you know, 3 to 5 miles on average, a lot. It's going to hit the ground a lot. So I was able to get in those reps really quickly. It's not like shooting where I get one shot, you know, and I got to reshoot it. And, you know, I'm only going to do a couple hundred of those maybe in a range trip. I don't know how many footfalls you have, but it's a lot, right? Thousands of footfalls was a very quick process when you're running. But I had to slow down my footfalls, which means I had to physically move slower or even stop and then restart and make sure it was working. Now I can listen to my music again. Now I can talk again. Now I can go run up the hills. Now I can go trail run. Now I can go do all the things I enjoy doing while running. But for a while there, it was really difficult to change the way I had run for years and years. I'm like, oh, well, guess who doesn't have shin splints anymore, as an example, because I totally changed the way I ran. I trimmed 30 seconds off my mile time just by running differently. I was more comfortable. It improved my performance. I saw the benefit and it was worth putting in the effort. So I used the step learning process. I had to stop completely what I was doing. Add in a whole bunch of hard-pointed steps again. I run with my arms differently now. That's something I developed on my own. My shoulders were hurting. I would run with my thumbs up like the United States Army taught me how to run. Thumbs up, thumbs up, thumbs up. Pump those fucking arms, right? Yeah, you know what that does? It wears your ass out. So I stopped doing that, and now I let my shoulders relax, and I let my hands – I actually think I'm digging as I run, right? When I run, I dig. And they just kind of move down by my side now, and I just dig. And it's really easy. It's easy for me. I think of myself climbing or digging, and it's really easy for me to do that now. And again, it took me a long time to change that. And even now, it's probably been a couple of months, but it hasn't been that long since I've caught myself running with my thumbs up.
Well, and even to say, I mean, just recently we discovered that I'm cross-eyed dominant. So now it's like retraining my whole entire self to reshoot my handgun again. And we did one class, and I did good for a little bit, but then I got super fatigued with it, and then I started getting super, super sloppy. But we were out there all day long, and I ended up switching back to my other eye because I was getting so sloppy.
And it's easy to become fatigued. It's easy to become tired when you're doing this, and that's when – and it's different when you're in a class. You know, obviously you're there for all day. But if you're doing it on your own time.
And you're fatigued, you should stop.
Yeah, you should stop.
Because then you're just going to get bad reps in. And then you're going to get sloppy. And you're going to think that that's acceptable. And that that's a better way to do it when you're not doing it. It's like even working out. You could do the same thing working out. If you are going to do that squat challenge, 30-day squat challenge or whatnot. And you're trying to push yourself and you're trying to do all these squats and you just want to get them done really fast. You're squatting really fast, but your form is poor. Then it's going to lead to other things like knee pain, back, lower back pain, all different types of stuff. So in reality, you really, really want to make sure you can get the most and the best reps in, even if it's just a little bit, right? Even if it's five or six, you want to get those five or six 100% perfect reps in. And not 100 reps in of sloppy whatever it is, whether it's shooting, your presentation shooting, whether it's pulling your trigger or anything like that. Once you start getting fatigued with something, just call it quits and be like, okay, because I am working on my stance, I am working on a very specific thing. Once that fatigue kicks in, you're just going to go and basically lose everything that you were just practicing because the fatigue kicks in and now all of a sudden you're just doing it super sloppy.
Because so, practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent.
Right.
Perfect practice makes perfect. And so it takes dedicated conscious thought. What we see people do in classes often, and I can kind of appreciate this and kind of it annoys me sometimes, honestly, but is they want to go faster. And it's like, look, if you just want to do what you do before you came here, why the fuck are you here? Like, why are you here just to do what you already did? Like, you have to stop. You have to make conscious effort to change.
Yeah.
It's going to be some time. You're going to see some failure. You're going to struggle a little. You're going to have to put conscious thought. You should be mentally exhausted at the end of a good training class.
Yep.
If all you are is physically exhausted, you didn't apply yourself or the instructor didn't teach you anything to apply. It's one of those two things. And it takes conscious effort to apply yourself. And I know it's difficult because you're just like, I just want to do it the old way. I just want to lift like this. I just want to fight like this. I just want to shoot like this. I just want to run like this. I just want to do this skill the way I'm comfortable doing it, even if I know it's not the best because I'm just tired. I'm mentally tired. Good. You should be. So I'm going to get to these questions here. The first one is how to move from slow, deliberate, and conscious practice to less thoughtful movements. That's what I just kind of covered is making it super specific and pointed. And then eventually, like the baby teaching itself how to eat, you will eventually get to the point where things are less thoughtful. I can be honest with you guys. I can't tell you the last time I thought about drawing my handgun. I could not actually tell you the last time I thought about drawing it. In other words, when I want the gun to come out of the holster, it appears in my fucking hand, right? Because I've done the motion so many times that the only time I truly ever think about it is when I'm demonstrating it for training, right? So I guess I could say I do know it's when I'm training. But I mean when I'm doing my own shooting, when I'm competing or if I'm doing anything for work or you know anything like that, I don't have to think, oh, shit, I should get my gun out. I just go, I need my gun and pow, there it fucking is, right? I don't think like, oh, I got an elevator, escalator, I got to go to your grip. Do I have a good stance? I don't need to do that now. But there's other things I still need to do that with. So the point is when do you get to that less thoughtful movement, that kind of muscle memory reflexive response? It's after all those reps. I have heard, and I could say based on my experience that I would back this up, that it takes about 1,000 reps until your body can do something even with any, you know, response. It takes about 3,000 reps before it's doing it on its own. And it takes about 10,000 reps if you're trying to overwrite something that's already been written. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of variations in there and there's a lot of factors that would change all that, but that's roughly what I've heard. So you think about, does that mean I have to go out and fire 10,000 rounds or fight 10,000 people? No, of course not, right? I got to go out and lift weights 10,000 times? Not necessarily, but it's all the individual movements that you need to be doing with those reps. You know, yeah, you want to learn how to run better and you put thoughtful process into your running, you're going to get those 10,000 reps really fucking fast, you know, because you're running and you're doing a lot of footfalls. You know, if you're throwing a punch, you have to throw 10,000 punches. I'm sorry. That's the only way to get around it, you know. But if you're shooting, you don't need to go out and shoot 10,000 live rounds. You just need 10,000 reps of the good motion, and then those rounds will validate that what you're doing is proper. The second question is, how to piecemeal out difficult sections of a given sequence. So, for example, he says acquiring a good sight picture, then integrating that into the larger pattern from weapon access to first press of the trigger, then with movement, etc. So this, again, is part of that step learning process. But oftentimes, I'll work on focusing or I'll work on focused skills. So let's say sight picture. I just go from a two-handed grip up at the center chest, collarbone level, and I work up to my eyeballs, and then I come back, and I work up to my eyeballs, and I come back, and I work up to my eyeballs, and I come back. All I'm doing is getting my body ready for this one motion. If this is the stepped pointed process, let's say, that I need to be working on, I don't need to do all of the things and this. I just need to go back and do that.
Yeah.
So when people are like, oh, I need to work on my trigger press, and I'm like, then why are you drawing from the holster? Why are you doing all your – work on your trigger press, man. Just work on your trigger press. Then start integrating in everything else when you've got that down. But if you're trying to do everything plus that thing, that's too many things. Sooner or later, you've got to start rounding out the edges. And as you do that on that step learning process, you've got to get to the point where you're like, okay, this is the thing I need the most work on. This is the thing I'm going to spend the most time on. Where that often fails with the piecemeal concept is that people don't want to do that. They want to do – what is the most comfortable, whatever the thing is that they have the most success with. So they get bored or tired or fatigued to doing something, and they're like, fuck it, I just want to do this other thing. And then they go back to doing the other thing, and then there we go. How to find and create failure points in solo practice and how to address them is the next question. And I will say one, and this kind of goes into some of the other questions, so I'm going to jump ahead here a little bit, but one is you need professional guidance. If you're trying to figure something out, you need professional guidance. Drew is a skilled runner. I went to a skilled runner to figure out how to run better. Could I watch YouTube videos on my own? Yes. Am I sure that they're right? No. Am I sure that they're personalized to me? No. Could I read lots of articles? Yes. Is that going to take a lot of time? You bet. And so sometimes when people are like, oh, but, you know, a training class might be, you know, $200-$300 or, you know, I want to go, you know, do some fighting lessons, but God, you add up 4 or 5, you know, weeks of that. Next thing you know, you're $1,000 in. It's like, yes, that's true. Under the watchful eye of a professional instructor or educator who's going to show you exactly what you need to do and what you're doing wrong. And if they can't do that, then they suck and go find somebody else. Or maybe it's not right for you. Maybe they don't understand what you're trying to accomplish. Go find someone who does. But to me, time is worth something. So for me to sit and read hours and watch hours of videos and articles, I'm like, fuck that, dude. I just want to go to someone who can tell me what to do. You know what I mean? Hey, what am I messing up here? What do you see me doing? So that's a big point on how to create those failure points is go to someone who can show you. And go to someone who can help you then create a training program for whatever skill you're looking at trying to improve that can push you to a failure point. So it's like, okay, cool. Let's use fighting for an example. No, awesome. All right, you're throwing this punch really well. It's solid, looks good. You're punching the static target. Awesome. Here's what we're going to do. I want you to start working on a moving target. Here's how you can create a moving target on your own. You know, and now you're just going to keep throwing this perfect punch that you've managed to build. Now you're going to hit a moving target. And you're going to have some failure there because you're not good at this. And that's okay. You're just going to work on this because your punch is already good. So let's work on the stuff you're not good at. Another way to do this is to just video yourself and either send it to somebody who can review it or just watch it yourself. I have made this offer before on the Arms Room
and
show.
I don't think we've ever had
anyone take me up on it. So I'm going to make the offer again. If any of you guys want help with a physical skill that we teach, combatives, shooting, medicine, whatever, if you'll video yourself doing the thing, try to get it from a couple different angles, try to make it a high quality video. Please don't film yourself from 20 fucking feet away and ask me what my opinion is, because I can't see that kind of shit. But
make sure it's done from an iPhone.
If it's on an Android, I'll watch it. Drew won't be able to figure out how to press play on an Android. But for you guys, if you want to send those in to us, and if the file's too big to email, just put it in Dropbox or whatever cloud sharing service you have and send us a freaking link. I will review it. Now, my review is not going to be based on, or I will have someone on our team review it. That's not going to be based on physical presence with you, and you're not going to be able to get as much as if you were in a class with us, but I understand our listeners are all over the place and you may not have that capability. So please utilize that. If you're a patron, all right, I'll say this is only for patrons, all right? It's $1 a month, guys. If you jump in and be a patron, you can have this service. But no one's ever utilized it, but I'm telling you, it's something I'll do for patrons. And if it's something that we teach about, send us the video. We'll analyze it as best as we can and look for failure points and figure out some kind of way to create that. The last thing I want to talk about with this, in addition to having someone else watch you or watching yourself, is creating standards. Your standards should be based on the realistic goals that you're trying to accomplish. I'm going to use these standards as an example. I'm not saying that there's no validity in these things, but what I'm about to say has specifically to do with shooting drills. I'll be honest. I don't fucking care how fast you run a 1-5 or a 2-2-2 or a 2-3-1 or a bill drill or an El Presidente or whatever. I don't fucking pick something. I don't give a shit. If you were to tell me what your time is, I would be like, that's fucking cool, bro. I don't give – if you have a sub-second draw, that's so fucking neato. I don't give a shit. Here's why I don't give a shit. What is the standard for what you're doing, and how can you contextually apply it to what you need to do? So create a standard. Like, those are just shooting drills to do for fun. And look, if you practice something over and 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 over, and over again, you're going to get good at it. Maybe you're amazing at a 1-5 drill. That's cool. That's out of context for real-world application. That's no, in my opinion, and I know Kyle Lamb created it, and he's a fucking badass motherfucking CAG operator dude. I understand. The dude's a soul stacker. I get it, man. But the drill is out of context for what the majority of people are using it for. It's just a shooting drill. It's a masturbatory drill. That's all it is. And it's nothing to do with Kyle Lamb. He's a badass. He's a great instructor. I'm not saying anything against him, but how people utilize the drills out of context. Find something that's for context for you. What are you training for? Competition? Then use competition-style targets. Don't use random shit. Use the targets you're going to fucking use in competition or as close to them as you can get. Are you training for self-defense? Use self-defense-based targets. You know, who are you training to fight? Are you training to fight other BJJ guys because you're going to compete in BJJ competitions? Then make sure you go fight other BJJ people within your capabilities at whatever gym. Bounce around to a couple gyms. Try some different people out. Work on that. Are you trying to train for a life or death situation? Then don't do what I just said. Go to a fighting gym and learn how to fight people. Because in BJJ, you don't stab anyone in the taint. In BJJ, you don't shoot anyone in the fucking dome. In BJJ, you don't gouge someone's eyeball. All right? So if that's what your context is, then go do that. You know, if you're going to practice running, what's your context of running? Is it only for health? Is it only for fitness? Is it only for fun? Is it for training for a marathon? Are you trying to train for a trail run? Well, then you better go get your ass on some trails. You know, like if you want to train for something specific, then the standards that you're going to use need to be realistic to your context and application. What time, right? If I'm training to run, what time should I set for myself? Should I look up the national champion and try to be that guy? No. Should I look up the best runner on our team and try to be that guy? No, I shouldn't. Their context of running and my context of running are not the same. Our body types are not the same. None of that. So how do I set a standard then for my time? Well, the first thing to do is to go out there and find out what you can do. That's set standard thing number one. Fuck looking up all the whoever runs a 1-5 drill, I don't know, whatever. 2.5 seconds. I don't fucking care. So it's like, okay, that's cool. Are you them? That person puts 10,000 rounds a month or whatever downrange. They're a professional shooter. They're a whatever. Like, that's not you, man. Why don't you go see what you could do, let's say a 1-5 or a 2-2-2 or whatever. Let's see what you can run it in. And then let's start there. Because if all you do is compare your performance with other people's results, well, guess what? They had a good process. That's how they got the results that they wanted. That's what we're talking about here is creating a process. Everyone is so goddamn results driven. No wonder they can't fucking do shit. Blows my mind when I'm training people. It's like, everyone's like, where'd that bullet go? Who fucking cares? What was your process like? What did you see through the sights? I don't know. Where'd the bullet go? What did you see through the fucking sights? What did you see? You're so goddamn concerned about where the fucking bullet went. No wonder you don't know where it went. What did you see in your sights, man? Yeah. Did they go up? Did they go left? Did they go right? You pulled your head away from the gun so damn fast and threw the safety on your carbine because you want to look like some faggot-ass moron on Instagram. You have no idea what happened with your presentation and shot because you didn't even stay in the situation. So, yeah, now you want to create a standard? I can't help you. You got to see what you're capable of doing. Then, once we have the process down, now let's start worrying about the results. I don't care if you go out there and run a 15-minute mile. Kudos on you for going out and running. I don't care if you walk half of it.
Yeah, at least you're out there.
Now we know what your standard is. It's 15 minutes. Now let's drop that standard realistically. Next week, I want you doing a 13-minute. Nope, that will create a failure point that might be if some guy is 50 pounds overweight and he has busted ankles and I tell him he needs to shave 2 minutes off his time in 2 weeks, that might not be possible for him. Let's create a standard for somebody or standard for yourself that's reasonable and achievable. I'm not saying jerk yourself off and make it real easy, but create a couple. Like, I don't know how to set a standard other than go, okay, let's say I wanna run. I run a 10-minute mile. All right, I'm gonna practice on running a 10-minute mile as well as I can for the next week. And I'm gonna see if in a week I can trim off any time. Just is what I'm doing now that I'm working hard going to trim any time? Let's say I drop it down to a 950. Okay, cool. 950 is my new standard. Now that I've got that 950 standard, next week I'm going to drop it down to 940. I shaved 10 seconds off this week. Let's see if I can shave 10 seconds off next week. So now I try to make it a 940. All right, did I get to 940? No. I got to 943. Okay, then guess what my standard is next week? Fucking 940. And once I hit that 940, then I go, okay, it took me 2 weeks to go from 950 to 940. So in the next 2 weeks, I want to be able to get down to a 930. And maybe because I'm getting in better shape and my lungs are opening up and my muscles are getting good, maybe in 2 weeks, I'm down to a 915. Then I take 940 and 915 and I go, cool, it's a 25-second difference. So now I'm down to a 915. I want to be at an 850 by the end of the next 2 weeks. And I keep doing that until I hit a point of diminishing returns. Meaning based on my body mass, based on my physical capability, my age, any injuries, et cetera, maybe I max out, let's say, to 730, right? And that's as fast as I'm ever going to go. No matter how hard I try, I can't break 730. Now I have to ask myself, now that I've got the standard, is it worth continuing down this path where I'm trying to go from 730 to 720? Or should I look at other things that might improve my running? Like, okay, now I've got a 730. But how do I do on the trails? I've got a 730, but how do I do, you know, with a different type of running? Maybe now I got to try some different interval running, or I need to try some different method that's going to help me. Cool, I can get down to a 730, but because I've been focused on running so much, I've let my, you know, my actual physical strength slip. So maybe I need to go pump some fucking leg workouts so that, hey, now I might be able to get that 730 to 720, or at the very least, I'm going to be stronger. And what if I never get to 720? That's okay. I've set standards until I got to the point where I can't go any faster. Look, that's going to happen. There are people that can't do a sub-second draw. They fucking can't do it. I know. I've seen them. They're never going to do it. And for them to stand in front of a target at the ridiculously close range and the ridiculously huge targets that most people on the internet use to prove their sub-second draw, and you just stand there and just shoot, and then reholster, and shoot, and reholster, and shoot, and reholster, and then shoot, and reholster, and then finally one time they get it and they're like, victory! No, not victory. Can you do it again and again and again and again? And if you can't, who fucking cares? Maybe the fastest you can do it is 105. What's the context of why you're trying to create this standard? Is it for self-defense? You think 5/10 of a second is going to mean the difference between life and death? You don't know anything about fucking self-defense fights. Don't worry about it. Stop what you're doing. Go start researching actual fights go start actually looking into criminal behavior. And then when you come back, you realize how fucking stupid this shit is, and you'll work on the stuff that actually matters. Or if you really, really, really want to get sub-second draw because you're a USPSA shooter and 0.5 of a second can literally mean the difference between first and fourth place because those guys are psychotically close to each other, then keep going, man, and figure out what is it my fast twitch muscles? Do I need to work on my arms more? Is that the type of holster I'm using? What kind of drag is being created on my holster? You know, is my belt in the way? I didn't tuck in my shirt. Like, now you start looking at the finer points of what's making you slower. But if the context of what you're doing doesn't support what you're doing for a standard, then why in the hell are you doing it? If it's not just for fun, it's got to be something else. How to add stress. Stress or pressure in training. Let me be clear about this. Running around the range does not add stress to training. Dressing up.
Having people scream at you does not.
People screaming at you and yelling at you does not add stress.
No.
Putting your body armor running around does not add stress. Doing stuff at night does not add stress. These things do not add stress. They do add task load. Like, no, I've got more stuff to manage, and so I might need to learn how to prioritize within. Like, someone's screaming at me, okay, I just prioritize. Don't fucking listen to that shit. Or if someone's trying to communicate with me, now I might have to prioritize listening. So those things don't add stress. And if you do those kinds of physical, I'm going to go back to shooting for a second. If you do stress shoots or you do heavy-duty stress workouts or you go out and run real hard, you know what's going to happen? You're going to fucking hurt yourself. That's all that's going to happen. You're going to hurt yourself. If you're like, I'm a white belt in jits and I'm only going to fight purples, sooner or later you're going to get fucked up. You're not just going to lose a lot. You're going to get fucked up. They're going to hurt you on accident. Because you don't have the self-control, the knowledge, and the experience to know that when they're doing X, you don't fucking Y, and you're going to Y, and you're going to hurt yourself. And another blue or purple belt may go, okay, when they've got me in this position, I can't do this, or it's going to hurt me, so I either need to tap out or figure out another solution. So don't put yourself in a situation where you're going to hurt yourself, or you're going to create so much failure that it's overwhelming, because we are emotional and mental beings, and it will crush us if we are just continually experiencing massive failure after massive failure after massive failure. So how do you add actual stress? Stress the skills within the standards. So you want to add stress. Oh, let's go back to jits. White belt against white belt. Give me a time. Restrict the amount of time that I have to do things. That can help create a little bit of stress. Stress the skill. You only fight gi, fight street clothes. You only fight street clothes, fight gi. First time someone cross collar chokes you and you haven't been in a gi before, you try to figure out what the fuck just happened. But you haven't fought in a gi before. Now you're stressing your skills. Oh shit, look, there's a skill I don't have. I don't have a solution to that problem. So stress the skills that you're trying to stress within the context of how you're trying to use them. If I'm a runner, I'm not going to stress my skills by going, okay, I normally only run 5 miles, but tonight I'm going to run 15. Nope, you're going to fucking hurt yourself. What instead you need to do is go, hey, I normally run 5 miles on the pavement. So tonight, to stress my running, I'm going to go run in the sand. I'm going to go run suicide sprints. I'm going to go do something that's going to stress my overall running skill. Not, I'm going to have someone run behind me screaming at me. Well, that's not going to fucking help. If you did the same stupid-ass shit that people do in the shooting world, and you did that in almost anything else, everyone would laugh at you. Mm-hmm. Because it's so fucking stupid. So don't do things that are just arbitrarily. And if you're training with someone who does that shit, don't fucking train with them anymore. Stress, in my opinion, in my experience of teaching, stress shoots are injury factories. That's all they are. They just hurt people, or they show people, oh, you're so weak, you can't flip this tire. Well, have we been working on flipping fucking tires today? If no, then why are we stress shooting flipping tires? Why would we do such a thing? It doesn't make any sense. We're going to wrap things up here with these last couple questions. I don't know if we're going to have enough time for everything, but what works best for you personally, me personally? I've already told you guys what works. How to make the best use of partners. Find a partner that wants the same result you do. They want the same result. Drew and I do well in training together because we want the same result. We're trying to accomplish the same thing. In running, we're trying to accomplish the same thing. In shooting, we're trying to accomplish the same thing. If your USPSA buddy wants to go shooting with you and wants to train with you, and you are all about drawing from concealment, I'm not saying you two shouldn't shoot together. I'm just saying that's not going to be the best use of your time. You're going to have fun with your buddy, and you're going to shoot some of his drills, and he's going to shoot some of yours, and you guys are going to have a good time, and ultimately you will improve your skill, but you're not making the best use of it. The best use of a partner is going to be someone who has the same standards you do. Like, as an example, I don't like training with someone. If I'm fighting and I'm trying to learn a new skill, I don't want someone who's going 100% with me and just fuck me up constantly. That is for Hollywood movie shit. If someone's just, if I just go to Cecil, I'm like, okay, Cecil, fight me at 100%, right? We're going to go jits only and fight at 100%, Cecil. And he just fucking wrecks me over and over and over again. What am I learning? I'm learning that Cecil, shocker, is better at jits than I am. That's all I'm going to learn. I'm not going to learn anything. But if I can go to him as a, you know, fucking whatever level black belt he is at this point, and I can go, okay, dude, I want to be your training partner. I am nowhere near your level of experience. Here's what I'd like to work on. I really want to work on, you know, getting a better wrist grab. I can't quite get that wrist control down. And he goes, okay, cool. He, as a good training partner, is going to go, I got to go all the way back to, you know, white belt days, and I got to help Glenn get a better wrist lock. And so then he's just going to help me. Now he's going to add pressure as I get better, and then he's going to back things off as I don't. And I start to fail, he's going to either stay there or back it down a little bit so I can have some success and go, okay, cool, I got it. Let's up the tempo a little bit. That's a good training partner. Someone who's just like, I'm in so much better shape than you and I'm so much better shooter than you. Let's go to the range so I can fucking show you. Like, that's not the kind of friend or shooting partner I want. I want the guy who's like, hey, man, what are you looking for today? What am I looking for today? Let's figure out some exercises that are going to get us both where we want to go. Man, what have you gleaned from others in terms of methods of practice? Everything I just fucking said. I did not come up with all this shit by myself. This is my other instructors and independence training. This is other people I've learned with and learned from. This is me taking examples of what I didn't want to do and making them hard steps for stuff that I do want to do because I definitely don't want to end up over there. Everything else that's kind of on this list is everything I've talked – except the last point, the last question is this. How do you keep yourself accountable? This might be the hardest part.
Mm-hmm.
I want to give John Pinnock's kudos here.
Mm-hmm.
John Pinnock's, of course, John's, you guys know him here on the show. John is a guy who he's always struggled with physical fitness. It's never been his strong point until now. He keeps himself accountable. And I would say, you know, for the past quite a while now, I mean, well over damn near probably 2 years, maybe more, especially since he quit smoking, he has held himself accountable by he posts his workouts on Instagram.
And then tags us in them.
And tags our people in them.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not saying, because I know John, he's not saying, look what I can do. Because some of the stuff he's doing is not better than what we can do. So he's not trying to compete with us. He's not saying, you know, look what I can do. I'm working out. He's holding himself accountable to us. He's holding himself accountable. Look what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I told you I was going to do this, and now I'm doing it. Accountability, if you can find a way to be accountable to somebody else, it's always going to be better than only being accountable to yourself. Being accountable to yourself is difficult because it's easy to make excuses, but other people, good partners, good people who are going to hold you accountable, aren't going to accept your excuses. So if you find someone who's like that, that's a good training partner that will hold you accountable. Hey, I don't feel like, you know, I don't know. We had a few weeks ago, Drew was like, I don't really feel like going to the run tonight. And I go, perfect. That's the perfect time to go to the fucking run. Right when you don't feel like doing it. And we ran and she felt good afterwards. Because we want to hold each other accountable for things that we want the other person to be doing. And this is the hardest part to do, especially personally. Here's something I've used. Set yourself a true, and you got to stick to this, a true rewards-based system. Like, hey, I'm trying to perform X skill, whatever it is. Hit a certain, you know, fighting thing, shooting thing, running thing, whatever physical skill you're working on. If I can get to that level, and maybe you want to put a time crunch on it, maybe you don't, but if I can get to that level, I'm going to reward myself by doing this. I'm going to go take a cruise. I'm going to go buy myself that gun I wanted. I'm going to go, you know, whatever. I'm going to take 2 days off from work and veg out and play fucking video games. Whatever it is that you like to do, okay? Reward yourself for being accountable. Some people's reward to themselves comes internally. My reward to myself comes internally. So the way I reward myself is internal. But if you need an external reward, there's nothing wrong with that. Set up a system that rewards you for doing the things that you said you were going to do. That's what we got time for. We're trying to stick to the hour platform again.
We got yelled at by a lot of people.
I appreciate you guys who said, hey, you guys' podcasts are sometimes like 2 hours long and I love this show, but can you break it into two parts or something? It's killing me. We're going to try to go back to the hour thing. We really are. We're trying to stick to it. So how long are we right now?
An hour.
Perfect. I can read time still. Awesome. What did Drew and Glenn do this past week to better prepare any of the four zones for an emergency? That's the independence training moment. What we did was help transitioning one of our kids to adulthood responsibilities. Drew spent a lot of time with our oldest, teaching him about how to properly organize a call tree when you're trying to figure out the solution to a problem so that you don't, you know, duplicate efforts, and that how to properly record that information from that call tree so that when you have contacted this person and got this information, you can make the right notes so you don't have to call them back. And how to make sure that you take notes beforehand that says, when I get a hold of this organization or whatever, these are all the questions I'm going to ask them so that I don't have to call them back. And so Drew did a great job of helping him get everything set up so that as he moves into adulthood now, he's more responsible. It takes the responsibility off of us and makes him more prepared as family, which is zone two. Makes him more prepared to be a proactive member in society. So I just want to say thanks to Drew for that, because it was a lot of time and effort and work on her part. And that is our independence training moment for this week. You can find us at trainingaz.com. We're proud members of the Heroes Media Group. Make sure you check out the other shows on the network, as well as the other services that they offer, from publishing and transcription to actual media production. Next week, we're going to talk about building a self-defense resume for the fight after the fight. If you find yourself in some fucking Kyle Rittenhouse type situation, how do you build yourself up now? We like to say in class that means being a responsible, intelligent, mature adult. How do you build yourself up now, or at least the appearance of so, so that the fight after the fight is easier rather than harder? Never going to be easy, but easier as opposed to being harder. Until then, stay safe and train hard. You've been listening to the Arms Room.